Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and vice president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. This event is inspired by several reports by the Pew Research Center, which looked at different security perceptions across the United States, Canada, Western Europe, Australia, Japan, and South Korea, and at the discrepancies in security perceptions between American public and American scholars. To present the results and help us to put them in perspective, we welcome Jacob Pushter, who was the lead on this research and whose presentations are always a highlight of our global affairs conferences. Now, a word about Jacob. Jacob Pushter is the associate director at the Pew Research Center. He is an expert in international survey research and writes about international public opinion on a variety of topics, including the international image of the United States and perception of global threats. Jacob, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Colin. Thank you for having me. I know this is virtual and typically we would do this kind of thing in person, potentially in Ottawa, but I really appreciate allowing me to present this data to our group here. So I'm going to go through the slides and talk about all the data that we've collected over the last year. And, you know, we can hold questions to the end, but if you have any questions about methodology, the kind of work that we do, what countries we survey in, or anything else you're interested in, feel free to put it in the chat, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. So this presentation is about threat perceptions across 14 democracies, and Americans included, and a little section on what U.S. foreign policy scholars think about these various threats to the United States. So the Pew Research Center, first of all, we're a nonprofit fact tank that informs the public about the issues, attitudes, and trends shaping the world. We're a subsidiary of the Pew Charitable Trusts, which is our primary founder. And our goal is to generate a foundation of facts to enrich the public dialogue. So we conduct public opinion surveys around the world and sort of put out those results so people can understand it and hopefully use it in their day-to-day jobs. So the methodology for these surveys, these were nationally representative surveys across 14 surveys in the summer of 2020. All respondents were selected via dual frame. In other words, we called people on landline and mobile phones using random digit dial techniques by telephone in all the countries that we surveyed. Margin of error is anywhere between 3.1 and 4.2 percentage points, depending on the country. And then there's also some supplemental data from an IR scholar survey, which is conducted by the Teaching Research and International Policy Project, which is associated with the College of William and Mary. And that was of IR scholars in September, which they asked some questions that we had asked on our public opinion surveys, which so we can compare the data. And there's also some information from a March survey. So let's quickly look at threat perceptions across the 14 democracies that we surveyed. So these are the medians across these 14 countries on whether the following things are major threats to their country, minor threats to their countries, or not a threat to their countries. And what you'll notice, first of all, is that among the threats that we asked about, global climate change and the spread of infectious diseases, obviously with the COVID-19 pandemic, are the top concerns across these countries. There is some variation within the countries, but overall, these were usually the top two threats named by the people within the countries that we surveyed. But despite that, people are still very concerned about basic security threats around the world and in their country. 66% say that terrorism is a major threat to their country. 65% say cyber attacks from other countries are a major threat to their country. And 61% say the spread of nuclear weapons is also a major threat. So these are all sort of traditional security concerns that people, you know, despite the pandemic, still say that are major threats to their countries. A little lower on the list is the condition of the global economy, although that has risen as a threat in the minds of many people over the last year, obviously with the recession, the pandemic-related recession, and fewer still are concerned about global poverty. And then at the bottom of the list, migration, only 40% across these countries say that the large numbers of people moving from one country to another is a major threat. And when we surveyed in 2016, a lot more people were concerned about this issue than are now. So among the threats that we name, it is usually the lowest threat across the countries that we survey. So let's look at this on an individual country basis. This is a pretty interesting chart. This is our European countries. And the patterns that I showed in the previous slide sort of hold here, except for the fact that in these European countries, almost every person says global climate change is the greatest threat to their country. So despite the pandemic, despite the spread of COVID-19 around the world, people in these countries still see global climate change as the greatest threat to their country compared to the other threats which we name. There is some variation by country. In the UK, the spread of infectious diseases is the top threat. In Denmark, cyber attacks is the top threat. But overall, global climate change is certainly on the top of people's minds in Europe. And at the same time, the large numbers of people moving from one country to another are not at the top of the list among the European countries we surveyed. Again, quite a change from 2016. And as you see here too, you know, concerns about terrorism, cyber attacks are also pervasive across many of these countries. Usually majorities or more say that those issues are major threats to their country. So that's the European look. When we look at other countries in our survey, so Asia Pacific countries, Australia, Japan, South Korea, and then North America, US, Canada, you see similar patterns, except in these countries, generally the spread of infectious diseases is seen as the top threat. And that's the case in both the US and in Canada, it's tied actually. 67% say the spread of infectious disease is the top threat, and 67% say global climate change is the top threat. Beyond that, you know, most people, again, name migration as sort of the lesser threat here, but people are also very concerned about the condition of the global economy in South Korea. And in Japan, they're concerned about the spread of nuclear weapons, and that's pretty consistent from year on, year out. But again, you know, these general patterns hold across these 14 countries, and overall, most people are concerned about the basic security threats that we see year in, year out. Looking more specifically at the American views of infectious diseases, one interesting thing that we note is that older people and that those with a lower income and less education tend to be more concerned about the spread of infectious diseases than are those of other age categories, other education categories, and of higher income. These differences are not huge. Generally, you know, worries about the spread of infectious diseases is pervasive across the United States. But there are these interesting demographic patterns that we see in the United States that are, you know, unique to this particular threat, as is the spread of infectious disease across the United States. We've also seen some changes on whether the condition of the global economy is a major threat in many of these countries. For example, in Canada, only a third of people named the condition of the global economy as a major threat in 2017, but that's climbed to 60% in 2020. Same thing in the US, 37% said the condition of the global economy is a major threat, and that number is now 55%. So again, general increases in those who say that the condition of the global economy is a major threat, as of course the recession related to COVID-19 has sort of, you know, gone around the globe. And you see that too in our Asia Pacific countries. Again, you know, half or less in Japan and Australia said that the global economy was a major threat to their country, but that's now, you know, 3/4 in Japan, about 6 in 10 in Australia. And South Koreans have generally been concerned about the condition of the global economy over time, but that's still also higher now too. Another threat perception that has actually gone up in this over the last 7 years, which we have data going back to, is views of climate change as a major threat. Now, this is an issue that when we first asked these questions in 2013, people were concerned about climate change, but it wasn't at the levels we see now. And again, this is sort of the interesting thing about this data, is that even in the midst of a pandemic, even with all the other security-related concerns that we see around the world, people still think that climate change is either the top threat or the second top threat in most of the countries that we surveyed. And the perception of that threat has risen substantially since 2013, when we first started asking this question in most countries. So in the US in 2012, because we had some data from other surveys, only 45% said climate change was a major threat, and now that's 62%. In Canada, it was 54% in 2013, now it's 67%. So this is a major change that we've seen in global public opinion. There's just a lot more concern about climate change overall over the last decade. But the change in threat perception is not always shared by all people within these countries. So in the US, there is quite a stark partisan divide. In the most current survey, 85% of Democrats and those who lean towards the Democratic Party say that climate change is a major threat to the US, And among Republicans and those who lean Republican, that number is only 31%. So huge partisan divides, as there are in the US on many issues, but particularly on the issue of climate change. You know, Democrats have increasing numbers say that climate change is a major threat, but Republicans have really not changed as much in the same time period. So this is not unique to the United States. In many countries, those who are on the right politically are less concerned about climate change than those on the left. So this is not unique to the United States, but the partisan gaps in the United States are particularly large and have grown larger over time. When you look at partisan gaps on all these threat issues, what you see is that, as I said in the previous slide, climate change is the biggest threat. Just as a caveat here, this data is actually from our March survey because we had a couple other threat perceptions in it, including Russia's power and influence and China's power and influence, but it's basically the same kind of data. And we see that overall, Democrats are more concerned about global climate change than Republicans, which, as I showed in the previous slide, is a long-term change. But also, Democrats are also more concerned about Russia's power and influence than are Republicans. They're more concerned about global poverty, and they're more concerned about the condition of the global economy than are Republicans. There's not a big partisan gap in terms of the spread of infectious diseases. Most in both parties say that that is a major threat to the United States. So that's an interesting area where there's sort of partisan agreement, which is a rarity in US public opinion nowadays. Going down the list, there's also not much difference in terms of, you know, Democrats and Republicans on whether the spread of nuclear weapons is an issue, cyber attacks, China's power and influence. That's a really interesting finding because we've shown that views of China have gotten much more negative in the US and in other countries, Canada, Australia included, over the last year. And this is also sort of a bipartisan sense that, you know, concerns about China are shared by Republicans and Democrats alike. The only issue where Republicans are much more concerned than Democrats is on the large numbers of people moving from one country to another. So, you know, here, Republicans are much more concerned about migration as a global threat than are Democrats. And again, this tracks with data we've seen in other studies and is not particularly surprising, but it's sort of interesting to see that's where there are some differences. There's also a slight difference on terrorism with Republicans more concerned than Democrats, but it's not as large as the issue on migration or climate change. There's also an age gap in the United States. This age gap is not particular to the United States, but it's pretty pervasive. In general, those who are 50 and older are much more concerned about the various threats that we ask about, especially on the security threats, than are those who are 18 to 29. For example, you know, cyber attacks from other countries, an issue that a lot of Americans say is a major threat to the United States. 81% of those who are 50 and older say it's a major threat versus only 58% of those who are 18 to 29. The only question on which this is reversed in the United States is actually climate change. Young people are more concerned about climate change than those who are 50 or older. And this is something too that we see in a couple of the other countries we surveyed, although it's maybe not as pervasive as you would expect. In a lot of the European countries, everyone is concerned about climate change. So there's not as much of an age differential in those countries. But you do see these kinds of patterns emerge over the other countries, especially on the security threats. So this chart has, you know, obviously a lot of information on it, but the general sense is that, you know, across the 14 countries that we survey, the older people just are more concerned about terrorism. They're more concerned about the spread of nuclear weapons, and they're more concerned about cyber attacks from other countries. So again, those basic security threats, these are areas where the older generations in many of these countries are more concerned than the younger generations, and it's consistent across the countries we survey. So this is a pretty solid pattern that we see in our data, and it's not something new. We've seen this in the past as well, those who are older just being more concerned about these various security threats around the world. And then there's also another interesting gap that we see in our data. We don't often see gender gaps in the research that we do, but climate change is one area where women are more concerned about climate change is a major threat than men. On the other security concerns, we don't see much difference in terms of gender, but this is one interesting area where women are more concerned. They also are a little more concerned about the spread of infectious diseases and the threat of COVID overall. We've seen in our data that more women than men see it as something that's changed their personal lives. And that's an interesting pattern that we're actually going to continue to try to track as the pandemic sort of moves into its next phase. And then, as I said earlier, there are some political differences on many of these questions. Generally, those on the left are more concerned about climate change, but those on the right are more concerned about the large numbers of people moving from one country to another. Again, this is pretty consistent with what we've seen in the past, especially in the 2016-2015 period during the refugee crisis in Europe. You know, those on the right were obviously a lot more concerned about migration than those on the left. But even without that crisis, the pattern still persists, and where the political differences on many of the other security questions are not as apparent, although it is also apparent on terrorism. In other words, those on the political right are more concerned about terrorism generally than those on the political left, again, as those on the left are more concerned about climate change than those on the political right. So, you know, all this data sort of flows together. It makes sense across the nations that we survey, but I will emphasize too that these countries that we surveyed were more limited than what we normally do because of the pandemic. We weren't able to do face-to-face surveys in many countries. So we weren't able to do a lot of developing countries in the global south, big democracies like India. We hope to do that in the future, but for now we're sort of stuck with only being able to do telephone surveys, which is our preferred mode of doing surveys in most of the countries that we survey. And for the final part of this, as I said earlier, there was a survey that was done by the TRIP project as William and Mary. And here we were able to compare what Americans think about these various threat perceptions and what these IR scholars think. So the big takeaway from this comparison is that Americans and, you know, across these 14 countries, so, you know, Europe, East Pacific, all these areas are more concerned about terrorism than IR scholars. So 69% of Americans and a median of 66% across these 14 countries say that terrorism is a major threat to their country, but only 14% of IR scholars say the same. So this is a yawning gap. And it's something that's very interesting when, you know, you ask about terrorism to the general public and people are very concerned. You know, they're more concerned when there are more visible terrorist attacks, but even when there aren't, this was taken before a lot of the issues in France over the last month, but there's still a lot of concerns about terrorism among the general public, but not among IR scholars. There are similar gaps, although not as large in terms of the spread of nuclear weapons and Russia's power and influence. In other words, Americans and those across the 14 countries say the spread of nuclear weapons, you know, about 6 in 10 to 2/3 say that it's a major threat, where only about 1/3 of IR scholars say the same. Big gaps in terms of Russia's power and influence, a smaller gap on China's power and influence. This is interesting too, because, you know, IR scholars are less worried about China's power and influence than they are about cyber attacks or the spread of infectious diseases, which I think is sort of interesting to see. And Americans too are less concerned about that, but that concern has been growing over time, again, as negative attitudes towards China become more embedded in America and across a lot of these 14 nations. Not much difference in terms of cyber attacks and spread of infectious diseases between the general public and these IR scholars, but you'll see the reverse is true for climate change, where 88% of these IR scholars say that climate change is a major threat versus only 70% across the 14 countries and 62% among Americans. So this is the only question that were asked on both these surveys where more scholars say that it's a major threat than do those of the general public. I think this is really interesting because, you know, these IR scholars do tend to be more on the left, I would say, based on, you know, how they've answered questions about, you know, who they want to be president, on what their political affiliation is. And I think that explains some of the differences, but it can't explain all of it. So the fact that IR scholars are so little concerned with terrorism and so very concerned with climate change is a really interesting finding that we have here. And then finally, we also asked IR scholars about how the various countries have sort of dealt with the COVID pandemic. And here we see a little more agreement in terms of these IR scholars and Americans and across these 14 countries. So IR scholars, you know, say that the EU handled the COVID pandemic well, and people in the US and across these 14 countries agree. IR scholars are also pretty positive on the WHO's handling of the pandemic. as most across these countries agree and a slight majority in America agree. But the IR scholars also say that the U.S. has not handled the pandemic well. Only 3% say that the U.S. has handled it well versus 47% among the general public, and then 15% across these 14 countries. In fact, we saw image of the United States plummet pretty strongly over the past year. And a lot of that was tied to the U.S. response to the pandemic, which most publics outside of the U.S. characterize as bad. And I think the most interesting finding here is that IR scholars seem much more keen on how China has handled the pandemic versus people in these countries. So 61% of these IR scholars say that China has done a good job of dealing with the coronavirus outbreak versus only 31% among Americans who say that, and 37% median across the 14 countries who say that. But when it comes to, you know, whether we should approach China, you know, we should hold them to account for human rights violations or should deal with them on economic issues, both IR scholars and Americans agree that they'd rather, you know, rather hold China to account for human rights issues rather than deal with them on economic issues. So there is some areas of agreement between IR scholars and Americans and these public.
Thank you very much, Jacob. As always, my head spins because there's so much to sort of take in. My first question to you, because we're doing this in the wake of the US election, where there were some questions about whether pollsters were truly getting a fair picture of those they were surveying because of some of the margin of error differences, particularly in the Midwestern states. So my question to you is, when you do your polling, how confident are you that you're truly getting a representative picture, portrait of the public? And if you want to speak to a little bit of what may have happened, because you know we saw this in the 2016 election where there was a sort of a gap between what polls predicted and what was, and we saw this not in every state, but certainly in some states this time. So it leads to the question, which I'm sure other listeners and watchers will have, is how confident are you that your polling is truly representative?
I mean, it's a great question. So, I mean, there's a couple of responses to that. First of all, you know, we're still in the United States, we're still counting votes. So it's very hard to do an assessment of the polls before those final numbers are in. But at the Pew Research Center, we've actually already started to come up with, you know, theories and starting to think about research that we can do to sort of confirm how the polls, you know, did in 2020 versus 2016 and 2018. So, you know, there's colleagues of mine, including our director of survey research, Courtney Kennedy, who have already started looking at these issues. And, you know, at the Pew Research Center, we take a very, let's say, conservative way of looking at this. We want to be right. We want to make sure that we're looking at all angles. So we won't have any conclusions for quite a bit of time exactly what happened to the polls in 2020. So that's something to look out for. And it's something that, you know, I have to be aware of too. We obviously do surveys across the world, not just in the United States, but we're always concerned about data quality. We have a lot of ways to make sure that our sample is representative of the populations within these countries. We have a lot of demographic data that we go off of. We work very closely with our vendors in terms of contacting people to make sure that we're getting the right people in our surveys, to make sure that we have enough people to do analysis for, to make sure that we're not excluding groups that might be less likely to pick up the phone, that might be less, you know, available to us, or might be, you know, parts of groups that might have sort of higher distrust of pollsters or of media organizations and things like that. So, and, you know, our surveys, the ones that you're seeing data for here, are nationally representative to the demographic data of the countries in which we survey. They're not election polling. Election polling is a bit different because you have to narrow down the people that you survey to a universe of people that you expect to vote. And in this case, we're not actually talking about registered voters. We're not talking about likely voters. We're just talking about adults within these countries, usually anyone 18 plus within these countries. So, you know, to answer your question as simply as possible, we just don't know yet. We can't tell, you know, what, if anything, went wrong with the polls in the US this year. And our, you know, we take it very seriously to try to get as representative of a population in our surveys as possible. And we want to be right. You know, we want to make sure that those groups are not left out, because that, as you said, you know, would make our research less useful. Because if we're excluding certain groups for, you know, for reasons outside of our control, then we can't speak as authoritatively on this information. So, you know, quick answer is that we're looking into it and hopefully we'll have some resolution of it within like the next couple months.
Well, I'll just tell listeners that certainly during my time and posted in Washington and since then, I consider the work that the Pew Foundation, the Pew Research Center does as the gold standard. And you're my go-to source for polls. And I've certainly found in the past that that serves me well because of course practitioners use polling to help inform their analysis. And so I'm glad you are looking at discrepancies because it does affect obviously how the practitioners use your data as well. Maybe I'll get now into what you've come up with. If you're Joe Biden administration coming in and you've looked at these polls, and you've also looked at the, as you pointed out, the differences in Americans, whether Republicans and Democrats look at foreign policy issues, what would be a couple of issues on which there would be American agreement allowing a new Biden administration to proceed? You've covered, again, the number of threats, nuclear, cyber, terrorism, migration, pandemic. What do you see as sort of that we used to say low-hanging fruit that a new administration coming in wanting to proceed to try and bring the country together, proceed on a couple of foreign policy initiatives, knowing that foreign policy is probably not going to be the leader in the Biden administration? I think they're going to, as they've said, COVID's a top in the economy and jobs. But what about in terms of foreign policy? Can they find areas where they would find broadly bipartisan support? Because it looked to me like there were some areas in your data.
I think Americans generally see, you know, the COVID pandemic as an issue, as a global issue and something that, you know, would want to be solved. So that's one area of agreement. Americans are also still particularly concerned about security threats like terrorism and cyber attacks. That's something that hasn't gone away. It might have been overshadowed by other issues over the past couple, you know, months and years, but overall, people are very concerned about that, whether they're Democrats, whether they're Republicans. That's a bipartisan issue. I think the other area where there seems to be a little more consensus than there was in the past is actually China. What we've seen here is that views of China overall have really gotten much more unfavorable among Democrats and Republicans. So while the issues involved in China, you know, whether it's human rights, whether it's economic issues, whether it's trade issues, might be different across the partisan leanings of the United States, in terms of, you know, views towards China as a threat or China as an unfavorable, you know, aspect, that has actually, you know, remain the same and has gotten even worse. While Republicans have generally had a more unfavorable view of China over time, these data have moved in tandem. So, you know, back in 2005, similar numbers of Democrats and Republicans had an unfavorable view of China, 39% among Republicans, 34% among Democrats. And that's basically doubled among both groups in the last 15 years. So again, while this might not be an area of consensus about what exactly to do about China, there is a sense that China as a threat has grown in the minds of people in the U.S., regardless of which party they support.
And Jacob, it's true. Some of the other polling I've seen, I think that's reflected in a number of the other democracies that you've also surveyed as well, certainly Canada.
Yep. Back in 2005, when we first asked this question, only 27% of Canadians had an unfavorable view of China. That number has almost tripled to 73% in the current survey that we did. And this is true across these countries. You know, negative views of China are in many cases at their all-time highs. So this is something that we've seen in our data and has sort of come to, you know, a conclusion now where China, you know, used to have pretty positive ratings around the world and now has pretty negative ratings across most of these countries we surveyed. You know, views of the US are also pretty negative, but the fact that views of China have also moved more negative is pretty interesting.
It's interesting because as you pointed out in one of your earlier ones, the Chinese were seen to have handled this crisis much better than the United States.
Yeah, so even
they may be viewed as competent, but they're not viewed as trustworthy.
So this is among the general publics, these 14 countries. And what you see is this is a question about handling COVID. And you can see here that most people say that their own country did a good job of handling COVID. Most say that the WHO did a good job. Most say that the EU did a good job. but views of China's handling of the COVID response are pretty negative, even though IR scholars say that China did handle the COVID pandemic okay. People do not. Again, this is tied to negative views of China overall. But you see that the American response is even worse. 84% across these countries say that the US did not handle the COVID pandemic well. So what we're seeing is an interesting time where views of the US have fallen and views of China have fallen, and views of international organizations have sort of remained steady. But overall, you know, among the two leading powers in the world, there's not a lot of support among the general publics in these countries.
Jacob, Mr. Biden has talked about one of his early initiatives to bring together the democracies, both in support of democracy, but it seems to me that there would be something Mr. Trump chose not to do. He chose to take China on kind of directly, bilaterally. But if Mr. Biden wanted to address certain issues, trade, human rights, he could probably do so with collective support from a broad group of democracies, because it strikes me that the public opinion, at least in those countries, would be supportive of an initiative, whether or not it was led by the United States, but at least from an American perspective, if Mr. Biden did want to show American leadership again, this would be an area where he could probably find broad support amongst democracies, or am I going too far?
So, you know, the general concepts of multilateralism are pretty much supported across these countries. People are generally willing to say that it's better if countries work together. They're more likely to say that, you know, working part of a global community is better than countries competing for interests across the countries, and that most say that cooperation on COVID would have prevented the number of cases within each country. So when you ask about the various outlines of multilateralism and multilateralist principles, there's a lot of support among the general publics for it. There's also fairly robust support for the UN in general. They see the UN as promoting peace, promoting human rights. At the same time, a lot of people doubt the effectiveness of the UN. They doubt that the UN listens to people like them. And there are some criticisms of the WHO, especially in places like Japan and China, and somewhat in the US in terms of their response to the current pandemic. So in the end, you know, those multilateralist principles are popular across these countries. But even with that, in the United States especially, there's a lot of partisan differences. Democrats are much more positive on multilateralism. They're much more likely to say that countries should work together and they're much more likely to have a positive view of the UN than are Republicans and those who lean towards the Republican Party. So, you know, within countries, there are still some ideological gaps that could be a bump on any road to more people supporting these principles. But overall, you know, multilateralism is generally the preferred mode of cross-national institutions. And, you know, our previous research shows that democracy is generally, you know, most people in these democracies like democracy. They might have some questions about how it's working in their country, but when we ask them, you know, whether they like democracy or versus other forms of government, it tends to be the most, you know, positive way of running a country.
So what you're saying is, while the principle of multilateralism and democracy still is warmly endorsed, it's the policy, it's the details that people really want to see. And that's where, bluntly, leaders have to find that line to sort of mobilize that broad principled support to apply it in a purposeful fashion in policy. Is that fair?
Yeah, and it really does depend on what country we're talking about and you know, who in that country, you know, is in your political faction. So, you know, those among certain groups in Europe, for example, those who support the, you know, Alternative for Germany in Germany, AfD, are less likely to want to cooperate with other countries. You know, those who support the National Rally in France are also less likely to want to be part of a global community. There's a lot of gaps that, you know, appear in both the United States, Canada into as well, but also in Europe, that are political in nature, that, you know, despite broad support for these principles, there are those groups who, you know, might vote in higher numbers or might, you know, have different coalitions that does hold back the entire country from, you know, blanket support for these issues. And that's, you know, that's always important to note that, you know, when you see the overall number from a country, sometimes it's not showing the whole picture. Sometimes it's not showing the underlying demographic data that might point to different outcomes than what the overall public says.
So what you've just described is, in a sense, polarized or kind of more extreme in the Altfort Deutschland and the French. We are aware of these, but they don't necessarily have majority support, but something you have to be conscious of in your leadership, which takes me to the United States. we have this impression coming out of this election that the United States is deeply polarized. Is that a fair assessment, or is that only on certain issues? Because what you've shown us is that in certain issues, there is, in fact, even between Republicans and Democrats, a convergence on certain issues. Climate's not one of them, but on, say, China and dealing with the pandemic and things, there does seem to be broader support. So polarization, how real is that, particularly in the case of the United States, which you, of course, have a lot of data on?
Yeah, I mean, polarization in the United States is pretty deeply embedded in the current politics of the United States. I think right now is sort of a difficult time to talk about it. We've obviously just had a big election. You can see the numbers. You can see how close, you know, this election was from a historical perspective. You know, it's pretty rare for incumbents to lose in the U.S. It's kind of a rare thing. But you know, the differences between states and how they voted, it can be pretty large. And you know, on most of the issues that we ask about, both on foreign policy and on domestic policy, there are pretty big gaps. The ones that I mentioned earlier are pretty much more the exception. And there are other areas where Americans do agree on certain issues, but even on fundamentals of, you know, the democracy itself, you know, facts, the climate change, of course, views towards wearing masks, for example, you know, the acceptance of election outcomes, those kinds of things, there are still very large gaps in the current state of American politics. And this is not something new. It's a pretty pervasive element of American politics and has been for many years.
All right, let me come at it another way. If the United States, as you've just described, is polarized, is the U.S. an outlier amongst democracies? You pointed out, you know, Germany has a faction, the French have bits, Canada probably has some. But in that sense, is the American exceptional, or are the other democracies we're looking at tend to be closer to the center and be less polarized?
Yeah, I mean, in general, the U.S. does stand out for the intensity of polarization. When you look at these issues across the globe, there are usually differences among those who put themselves on the right ideologically versus those who put themselves on the left. So those differences appear in other countries. They're typically not as large as they are in the United States. So polarization does exist and exists in many countries. It's just in the United States, it's a bit bigger and it's a bit more obvious from the research that we do.
Russia and China, how close are they? And any sort of comments you'd want to make about Chinese public opinion and Russian public opinion? I don't know whether, I didn't seem to be included in this survey, but I don't know whether you've surveyed China and Russia in the past.
We have surveyed Russia in the past 4 years. We actually haven't surveyed in mainland China for many years because of some restrictions on whether outside groups, NGOs can do survey work there. So, you know, last time we surveyed Russia was in 2018, as I said a couple minutes ago. Unfortunately, in the 2020 survey, we weren't doing surveys in face-to-face countries. And what I mean by that is that when we do surveys in much of the world, our interviewers actually go to people's doors and knock on their doors and sit down with people for 45 minutes. And in the current pandemic, that's not appropriate. It's not safe. So there's no data from Russia in this year. But, you know, Russians have generally seen terrorism as the top threat. When we do ask about these questions, overall, they have differences of opinions from a lot of the other countries in which we survey, you know, Europe in particular. And China, again, we haven't surveyed in many years, so I have no information on that. When it comes to the flip side, though, views towards China, again, have sort of gotten worse over the last couple of years. And views of Russia were never particularly positive and haven't really improved over the last couple of years either. When you ask about world leaders, you see that Angela Merkel, there's the most confidence in her across these 14 nations. There's a lot of confidence in the French president. Views towards Boris Johnson are split, but generally very negative impressions of the president of Russia, the president of China, and the president of the United States. These leaders are not seen very positively across these countries. It also holds for when we've done these surveys across the global South and more developing nations, but it's not usually as stark as you see here. So pretty little confidence in the leadership of Russia, China, and the U.S. in this current survey.
I know it wasn't included in this, but do you have any data on where the United States and Canada in terms of the exercise of sovereignty in the Arctic?
Unfortunately, we don't have much information on that question. We do, you know, of the countries that I think are part of that organization, I think we survey in the US, but, and Sweden, I guess, I don't know if they're a member.
The Arctic Council, yeah, is what you're probably talking about.
But, you know, we've surveyed Russia in the past, but we don't have a lot of data on that particular issue.
So the North isn't something you've covered, but perhaps in the future.
Yeah, we could. You know, what we generally find is that issues that are a bit more niche in foreign policy circles or among security experts don't tend to translate well to the general public. And I'm sure most people are, you know, I don't know the number of people who are aware of those issues, but my guess is that it's a fairly small amount of people. It might be different if we did a survey of like those countries specifically on that issue, but the surveys that we do are a bit more general in nature and not necessarily tied to topics like the Arctic Council.
Okay, here's one I know you have data on, and that's migration. Migration with sort of cross-cutting related to environment, related to the economy, sort of general views, I guess, first in the US, because I know you have a fair bit of data there, and then kind of, as you pointed out, certainly a number of European countries put migration higher on their list of concerns or threats.
Yeah, so the interesting thing about the migration issue is that when we surveyed in 2016, 2015, the refugee issue was such that a lot of countries in Europe, especially in Eastern Europe, the Poland, Hungary, countries like that, were much more concerned about migration as an issue. The Syrian refugee crisis was in full blow, and that was, you know, a major concern to people. But over time, that has reduced as a concern. And the effects of that are, you know, there's a couple of things that have happened. One, climate change is clearly the preeminent issue among Europeans in terms of the threats. But also, you know, during that time period, overall views of the European Union had fallen pretty sharply. So there was a lot less trust in the European Union to sort of keep borders, to sort of meet the concerns of Europeans overall. And since then has sort of changed. Now there's a little more support for the European Union. Views about the refugee crisis aren't as pervasive. So these are changes that we try to track over time. And you know, it's interesting to see how these things can change. In the US, migration is still a top issue on the mind of some people. You know, even into this year's survey, it was a concern, especially among more right-leaning individuals in the US, but it certainly has not been as prominent, especially in this year's election, as it was in 2016, when it formed a much bigger part of the first Trump campaign than it was in this year. And views on migration are still pretty much split in the US, you know, a lot more support for migration, for, you know, H-1B visas, for international cooperation on migration among left-leaning individuals, and a lot more concerns about migration, you know, some of the effects of migration, which could potentially lead to, you know, more potentially security threats, are much more prominent among those on the right in the US and elsewhere.
Hey, here's a last question before I ask you what you're reading. Of the trends that you've described and the threats that you have portrayed, what do you find the most troubling in terms of the trends?
You know, as a part of the Pew Research Center, we don't sort of specify what we feel about the data. We just sort of tell people what there is. So unfortunately, that's like a kind of question that I would love to answer. But in the end, I can't have an opinion about the data that we collect. I can just sort of show what's changed in people's minds. So one of the clear trends is that people are much more concerned about both climate change and the condition of the global economy in 2020 than they were in years past. That's a clear trend that we see across almost all the countries that we survey. So that, along with the pandemic, are pretty much at the top of people's minds when it comes to the security threats that we see. I mean, in terms of surprises, you know, again, you know, the migration issue has really fallen in terms of a concern across these countries. That's something that's been a change over the past couple of years, and something we're interested to see in the future. And then again, you know, the great power issues between the US and China, which we track pretty closely, the fact that both those major powers are now so unpopular in these countries is something that, you know, I find fascinating and really has a lot of outmoded prominence in our current debate. And it's going to be something that's critical for how publics see the world. A lot of that too, actually that reminds me of something, is that, You know, the German chancellor is just so popular compared to the other leaders that we ask about in the US and China and Russia. And that's something that's, you know, the prominence of Germany and the general positive attitudes towards Germany and its leader is something that has, you know, as the US and China have fallen in the minds of people around the world, is, I think, something to watch in the coming years.
It's too bad that Angela Merkel, which The Economist once described as the indispensable European, is not staying around because she's also the indispensable Democrat. Well, Jacob, thank you once again for sharing this wealth of data and for doing it in an erudite and revealing fashion. So it remains me to ask you one of our most popular questions. What are you reading these days? Novel, biography, whatever?
That's a really good question. I just started a novel the other day. It's a fantasy series from Brandon Sanderson, who, if you know epic fantasy, is sort of one of the top names. And he has a new book out that I just started last night. So that's typically, I go for the more escapist fare, because most of my day job is reading the news, which at this current moment can be pretty stressful on a day-to-day basis. So I do tend to go for the fiction, for the fantasy novels in my free time.
Well, excellent. And that's a good review, especially because sometimes these times seem rather fantastic. So fantasy reading is a good idea as a kind of a relief.
Yep.
Well, thanks everyone for joining us on this webinar with Jacob Kushter of the Pew Research Center. You can find the CJAI Podcast Network on SoundCloud, Spotify, and Apple Podcast. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to producer Charlotte Duval Lantoine and to Drew Phillips for producing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today.